This podcast is sponsored by Barrage Coffee. It's veteran owned and operated by Kyle Early. I can't thank him enough for his sponsorship. My next guest is a 31-year United States Marine, also the president and CEO of Project Healing Waters Fly Fishing, Todd DeGrossier. Appreciate you coming on, brother.
Alan, thanks for having me. It's a great show, and it's honored to be a guest on it.
Absolutely. For the listeners who don't know your background, I kind of like to start off with, you know, how you grew up, where you grew up, you know, and what led you to join the military, you know, just kind of a breakdown of what got you to where you are.
Sure. So I'm from Maine. I grew up in Maine. My dad was in the Navy, so we moved around a lot, but we always had a home in Maine. So when I graduated from high school, I went to college, just like all my friends did, and I was on the track team there and stuff. And after a while, I got tired of going to college. Most of the people I respected in my life I grew up with had served in the Marine Corps at some point. My dad was a Marine before he was in the Navy. So I decided out of the blue one day, I'd go down and enlist in the Marine Corps. So I did. Couldn't go to boot camp right away, so I already quit college. So I decided I'd ride my bicycle across the country, which I did with no money, which was a pretty interesting experience. And then came back, went to boot camp. My first meal in boot camp was Thanksgiving dinner. So I thought this is a pretty good deal. You get fed like this. People yelling at you, but you know, that's not a big deal. I became a Marine was promoted through the ranks. I was in infantry, promoted through the ranks to sergeant. In that time, I was a squad leader, infantry platoon squad leader, and a platoon sergeant for scout sniper platoon. I was a scout sniper instructor as well. I was selected for a commission program, Marine Enlisted Commission Education Program. Went back to college, Boston University, and after I graduated, became an officer, went back in the infantry. I served most of my time in the infantry, commanded at every level, did some other jobs in the Marine Corps as well. Recruiting duty was on different kinds of staffs and things like most people are. Eventually, I got promoted to lieutenant colonel and a major. I was an executive officer for 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. We were there during the Second Battle of Fallujah, which is where I was wounded. And then became a battalion commander for 3rd Battalion, 2nd Marines. After that, came back from that deployment, was in Iraq as well. We deployed to Iraq with both of those units, and was promoted colonel. And I was given command of the basic school. And when I got to the basic school, I developed really bad vertigo associated with my brain injury. Ended up on a medical board for review. They couldn't fix it. So I got medically retired in 2016. In the process, when I was going through physical therapy, my vision therapist recommended Project Healing Waters program that was at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, as a substitute for some of the physical therapy I was going through there. I had told her I grew up fly fishing as a kid and I had stopped because of my balance. So I got hooked up with a program there as a participant and immediately became a volunteer. Just got a really good experience while I was there. Was really helping me heal the camaraderie, the friendship of the program, and of course the activities that we do, which we'll talk about later.
Absolutely.
And then when my med board ended, I was found unfit. The previous CEO resigned, so I applied for the job, and they hired me in September of 2016. So I've been here since then. So that's kind of a snapshot of a little bit over 30 years.
Yeah, so there was two things that you mentioned. You rode a bike across the country, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was that experience like? And the second one was, you know, you said you got wounded over in mm-hmm. on the battlefield. If you could walk us through kind of what happened in that scenario and, you know, what unfolded, and just to give the listeners a good idea of kind of what happened, and then how was your bike ride across America? Like, where'd you go from state to state or
East Coast? I was working in a bar and kind of goofing around, trying to figure out what I was going to do for the next 6 months. Because I had to wait 6 months to go to boot camp. They told me I couldn't go till January of 86. So this was 1985. So I was doing triathlons. I was a pretty good athlete. I was on the track team at the college, varsity athlete in high school and stuff. So I got into triathlons, and so I was pretty fit. And I read an article about this guy, Lon Haldeman, who was biking across the country. So I thought I could do it too. I didn't really have a plan or map or even any money. I had a pickup truck that I sold and bought a bicycle with that, threw all my clothes in Salvation Army, and off I went. And we started in Maine. So I rode to the Maine coast and put my back tire on the coast, and I was going to go to the West Coast. I'm not really sure how I was going to get there, but had a couple $100 and off I went. And 6 weeks later, I was in Seattle, Washington. So it was fantastic. I didn't really have a plan. I didn't really have anything to do. So it was just kind of one of those things that, I don't know, I just felt like I wanted to do it. It was, you know, I got a really good sense of accomplishment from it, obviously, because it was really hard. But I met a lot of wonderful people. My God, I had the hospitality of this country. You know, I rode from all the way across from Maine to Seattle, Washington, went up through Chicago, went north, took Route 2 across the top of the country, went up over the Rockies, just beautiful country, and really met some really amazing people that welcomed me in their house and fed me dinner and talked to me. And I don't know, it just gave me a good sense about the country I was getting ready to serve. And then I came back and called my recruiter and told him if he didn't send me to boot camp right away, I was going to go join the French Foreign Legion. So I went to boot camp and the very next day.
How many miles would you ride a day approximately?
It depends. Some days, not too many. I average, it was 4,200 miles. So it took me 42 days. So I averaged about 100 miles a day. There were some days, you know, where riding across the top of the country is pretty flat and pretty wide open, and there's not a lot to see after a while. So I started riding at night and rode a couple hundred miles a day then to get to the Rockies. And then, you know, whenever I was climbing over mountains or stuff, those were pretty slow days. And I was pretty worn out by then too. So I was getting a little fatigued, and the last half of the trip was pretty mountainous, but beautiful, beautiful country. And just really some absolutely wonderful people that I met that just generous. You know, that's what this country is all about.
So. Was there ever a time when you're like, man, what am I doing? Should I turn around and go back? Or
yeah, that was probably two or three times every day when I thought, especially when I got too far away to kind of chicken out, which I wouldn't do anyway. But, you know, when you're sitting in the middle of the country and you don't have any money and you're wondering how are you going to keep going? You know, I mean, I don't know. It's just some things you do in life kind of set you up for what comes next, I think. And this was one of those things that I decided to do early on my own, and decided I wasn't going to quit. And I think it served me well later on in life too, because that was really hard. However, I did have fun. I met a lot of great people, and you know, hung out and drank beer with them. And I mean, it was cool.
Oh, that's awesome. So you want to get into where you were overseas and you got wounded? I think you got two Purple Hearts, correct?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. If you want to tell the listeners about each incident and what happened, you don't have to go into too detail if you don't want, you know, just to give them an idea of what happened.
Yeah, so I was the executive officer for 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, and most of what I'm saying is a matter of public record. It's in a couple books, and I was decorated for some of the stuff as well. But so we were on the far, if you look north to south on the city, we were on the far right for the Second Battle of Fallujah. We went on into a sector of the city called the Jalan District. As the fighting continued, we crossed line of departure in, I think it was November 7th, 2004, and went right in the city with our reinforced battalion. So I was the executive officer of the battalion at the time. Once we pushed in the city with our rifle companies, the battalion commander asked me to put together a task force to clear behind the buildings, because the enemy had put a bunch of caches of weapons and different types of ammunition that they were using to build these improvised explosive devices around. And a lot of stuff was coming right out of Fallujah. So he wanted to make sure that we had it all cataloged, number one, and that it was properly disposed of. So I was given the task to lead this task force, which I named Task Force Bruno. And we had folks from the headquarters company and half of 81 section, our mortar section every day, and whatever else we needed. We had EOD, you know, six or seven EOD teams. We had engineers. It was a pretty big group of people, and we just sort of fanned out across the city, which we had numbered all the buildings. And so we kind of systematically went through and just searched them all to make sure there was nothing left. If we found something, you know, we'd blow it in place because we didn't want to, put anybody at risk for moving it around. A lot of stuff was booby trapped. So we were just progressing through the city. And as we moved around, the enemy would kind of come try to get their stuff afterwards, and they'd run straight into us. So we got into a good number of firefights with them, which didn't work out so well for the enemy most of the time. So there's a couple of days we got in this a good group of folks, and they weren't leaving, and neither were we. So the first time was on December 12th. We had a bunch of guys pinned down a building. They weren't going to surrender, so they were going to have to die. So we had a good long fight there. That's the first day I got wounded. I got knocked unconscious a couple of times by hand grenades, and we were fighting in close quarters inside the building. At the end of the day, we had a bunch of us wounded, nobody killed, and of course the enemy didn't come out, so they were killed. And then about 2 weeks later, on December 23rd, same thing. We were just clearing across the top of the city. As the battle ended in November, the battalions that were on our left flank were pulled out, and we were given the top half of the city. So there's a road that runs from Fallujah to Ramadi. It's like a small kind of interstate, I guess, like in something in this country, and it's called MSR Michigan. So we had Michigan north to the top of the city, to the river, and the whole area up above. So we gradually had half the city. And as we got those other sectors, we were clearing through them as well. We fanned the companies out laterally across the city. And then we coordinated with the other units, friendly units that were there. And as we destroyed those caches, we ran into more of the enemy who were kind of sneaking around the flanks and things. On the 23rd, we ran into a pretty big group of them, initiated one of the clearing teams led by 81's platoon commander, Lieutenant Al Butler. And I didn't know it at the time, but we had three men killed in initial contact with them. And then the rest of them were pinned down. So I would tell them every day, for the rest of the people fanned out, that if move to the sound of gunfire, something happens, and I'll be there to tell you what we need to do. And if you get pinned down, I'll come get you. So we had people pinned down, so I was going to go get them, and so we did. And we had about an 8-hour firefight that day, probably a little bit longer. We got everybody out, including the Marines that were killed. And the enemy wouldn't surrender in that day either. So it's pretty much the same thing on a bigger scale. So that included a little bit more work. We had tanks up on the December 12th fight, but we had more tanks. I had two tanks up this time. We bombed buildings from air. It was a pretty long process. And we gradually just kind of, ended the fight. There was a good number of insurgents in that building that day. And they had no desire at all to surrender. It wasn't even going to happen. So they had to go. So we took care of that by the end of that day. When it was all said and done, two of my Marines, Sergeant Jared Kraft and Corporal Jeremiah Workman, both earned Navy Crosses, which is second highest award to the Medal of Honor. There were, I think, two or three Silver Stars that were awarded, and a good number of Bronze Stars with Vs. Of the 21 of us that were there initially, 18 were wounded, including me, several times. Nobody was leaving the battlefield. They get patched up and come back. So good group of warriors. Certainly was an honor for me to be able to just to have the privilege to lead them and to serve alongside them in this important battle in the history of the Marine Corps, for sure, and in the history of the war in Iraq. So that's how I got wounded. So I was exposed to a lot of blasts. I was knocked unconscious by hand grenades. We were fighting in close quarters as well. Because of the close proximity to the previous head injury I had on the 12th, I suffered what's called second impact syndrome, and it made my brain injury worse. I had my teeth busted up and, from the fighting, and I wasn't medevaced. I wasn't going anywhere. I was the executive officer of the battalion, and people were relying on me, and I could still function. So that's what I did. And as the years went on after that, the brain injury continued to get worse, and I would have symptoms of vertigo, and they would go away and come and go. And at the time, I don't think the injury was very well understood. I think we have a much better understanding of blasts related to our brains now, but there was just nothing. And so I think everybody was doing the best they could with what they had, and they were treating what I had like a concussion, post-concussive syndrome. So over time, it progressively got worse and led to my medical retirement from the Marine Corps. In the end, I think it all worked out well, because I'm here in this job, which I love, in an organization, which is just absolutely amazing. It's somewhat providential the way it all happened, where I transitioned and was in physical therapy, and there just happened to be a Project Healing Waters fly fishing program there with a lot of really wonderful people. I mean, the best people you could imagine. And many of the volunteers that we have never served in the military. They just want to help, and they're good people. And then I ended up being the CEO of the organization, which I never expected. So in the end of the day, I think if we focus, on others, things work out better for us in the end.
I agree 100%. What's your daily routine like? I mean, you spent, 31 years in the military. Is it you're still up at 5:30 in the morning, ready to do like some PT, or what's kind of your daily routine?
Yeah, I've got vertigo. Even now, it's severe enough where I can't run. I'm a Marine, so I try to stay fit. I walk and do what I can, split wood, do yard work. But I do get up early. It's a habit. It's a good habit. I mean, I was taught as a kid to get up early and get stuff done during the day. So it's a habit I carried into the Marine Corps, and the Marine Corps certainly reinforced that for a long time. But I have a real passion for the Marine Corps, for leading Marines, and I loved it. I didn't want to stop. And so I have a real passion for this organization as well. So I love it. I wake up in the morning excited for the day and the challenges that are ahead in the day. And I know that a lot of people rely on us, and we provide a really amazing rehabilitative service for folks. I'm inspired every day by them to get up and get moving and do something. I've learned over the years how to pace myself through, number of years in combat and just serving long deployments with the Marine Corps and the Navy. Some days are long, day's 24 hours, no matter how you slice it up.
Yeah. We're all human. We all make mistakes. Can you tell me about a time in the military that you felt like you made a huge mistake? What was it, and how did you overcome it?
I think we do all make mistakes. I've always been willing to admit, if I make a mistake, I'm always willing to admit that I'm wrong, and I have an obligation to make up for it. I believe that that's a foundational principle of having the virtue of integrity, is that you do what you say you're going to do when you're going to do it. If you can't, you have to make up for it, and you always tell the truth. Makes it easier to remember things if you're always honest about it. So I've made a lot of mistakes, I own up to them and make sure that the mistakes don't harm anybody. So that's kind of my philosophy of life. So, I could list out a whole bunch of things, but in general, I think that if we acknowledge through humility that we're here, not about me, it's about us, and it's about the plural pronouns, you know, we, our. And if we use words like that, it shows why we're really here. So it's not as important to be right as it is to do what's right. And so if you think you're always going to be right, you're going to have a hard time doing what's right at the end of the day on a lot of days, and it's going to harm your character. And then when your character gets damaged, people stop trusting you and you can't lead them. So I think a humble approach to life is, you know, if all the words in a dictionary, English dictionary, there's over a million. The most important one is humility. You know, I would say love is a close second to that. And so you can, if you kind of keep those front of mind as you move through life, I think things, you don't leave a wake of destruction behind yourself.
Yeah. You've attended many, many, many schools in the military. Can you kind of go over some of them, what they entail? Because a lot of civilians don't really know what the schools are and what they do. If you sure. kind of briefly go over a couple of them or all of them, just a brief description of them and what you do in those schools.
So, of course, just about everybody goes to some sort of basic training. And then after that, you go into the training for the job you're going to do in the military, which is called your military occupational specialty. So I went to boot camp at Parris Island, South Carolina in 1985. After I graduated from that, I went to this infantry training regiment, which is now called the School of Infantry. And I was trained to be an 0311, which is a basic rifleman. And then I reported to my first duty station. Eventually I got promoted to being a squad leader, was a promoted corporal and then sergeant. I was sent to the Scout Sniper Instructor School in 1987 and became a Scout Sniper Instructor. Mostly I grew up hunting. I was a pretty good shot, and I was real, really fit, you know, maxed out the physical fitness tests, and I was able to pass the basic information test for being a sniper. So I went to the school and I became a Scout Sniper Instructor and put together a sniper platoon at the duty station I was at. And then I got selected for commission program. So I went back to college as an active duty Marine. I had to pay for it myself, but I was there on active duty. So went to Boston University and graduated from there. And then when you become an officer in the Marine Corps, every officer goes through what's called the basic school. I ended up being the commanding officer of it later in my career. But so you spend your first 6 months there, no matter what you're going to do, doesn't matter what your MOS is going to be. If you're a lawyer, pilot, everybody goes. So Marine Corps has a unique trait of having this universal training for everybody. And it served us well in Iraq, because you could take any Marine and give them a rifle and you can teach them what they need to know to patrol and all that. And that's a huge value to the Marine Corps, being as small as we are. So I went there, and then I was selected to be an infantry officer, which you compete for your specialties as officers at the basic school, with a few exceptions. I think lawyers and pilots are most of them are guaranteed coming in, but the rest of us are dependent on, you know, how we graduated. So I went to the infantry officers course and became an infantry officer, and then was sent to my first duty station. And the Marine Corps does a really good job, and I think all the services probably do the same thing, of making sure that you're prepared at each rank with some type of schooling to make sure that you understand the duties and responsibilities. And there's a lot of focus on leadership development at every rank, junior, you know, from the fire team leader all the way up to the commandant. People are constantly going to school and learning. And so the value of a military organization also being, you know, putting a high premium on learning makes the teamwork and the leadership aspect of it better. So you'll find much junior Marines filling roles typically held by a higher ranking, you know, people in other services. It's just by nature of the size of our service and the way we operate. So, so I went to, you know, as a captain. I went to the amphibious warfare school. It's now called, I think, Expeditionary Warfare School. But that was a 1 year, you know, rank, a captain's rank training. When I was a major, went to the Commanded Staff College, Marine Corps Command Staff College, where I earned a master's degree. After I had command of my battalion, 3rd Battalion, 2nd Marines, I was selected to go to top-level school, and I went to Harvard Kennedy School for a year through their national security program, which was just a fantastic opportunity for me, being from the area, being a huge Red Sox fan, and having the opportunity to go to school for a year in Boston at really an amazing learning institution was just, you know, it was a good thing. So came back from that and, you know, went to my next assignments. And but there's a huge focus on education and learning through all ranks of the military. And I think sometimes people just aren't fully aware of how much energy and effort is putting into teaching, primarily leadership, but there's also a lot of skills that are developed as you go on, because they both go hand in hand.
Yeah. That's the thing. A lot of people don't realize how much is focused on all that kind of stuff, you know? And I don't even think the guys that are in the military are even getting that grasp of how much is going into teaching these guys, what goes into teaching them, you know. It's kind of crazy. How has your story shaped you into who you are today?
Well, I think we're all a product of our story. I think a lot of the things that I've been able to accomplish have given me the confidence to do other things that maybe I wouldn't if I hadn't taken a chance. I think I got a lot of confidence in myself from being able to complete this bicycle trip that was just kind of something I thought I would just do. It turned out that it was much more difficult than I thought it was. And I just was unwilling to quit. So this unwillingness to quit certainly served me well on a battlefield where we were getting banged up pretty hard, and leaving wasn't an option. So I think the way I was raised by my family, believing in the value of integrity and character, and having that taught to me as a youngster, is something I always carried with me. And I always felt like, you know, I had to represent myself in a way that was acceptable all the time. You certainly are expected to do that as an officer, particularly in combat. And so I think those things shape us as we go forward. And if we want to be leaders, you know, there's a continuum that we have to stick to, which is, you know, we lead ourselves first, and then we can lead others, lead teams, lead organizations, and lead change. But you can't skip any of those steps in the way. And so we all have to go through this sort of process of starting with ourselves. Who are we, and holding ourselves accountable to the things that we need to do, and personal responsibility for those things. And, you know, I took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States, and I take that very seriously. And there's a lot of liberty and there's a lot of freedom in there. And with both of those comes responsibility to make sure that that we're worthy of it, and that it continues on for future generations.
Yeah. I kind of want to shift gears a little bit and talk about Project Healing Waters, fly fishing. And I know you kind of hit on it a little bit, but can you go more in depth about what the organization does, how you can get involved with it? Can you donate to it? All the steps and procedures that, you know, the organization kind of goes over and helps veterans.
Yep. So we're a nationwide nonprofit. We have 225 programs right now, established nationwide at the end of 2020. Anyway, we did. We're always growing. So, you know, we grow a little bit. We grow about 1,000 to 1,200 participants a year, I guess, overall. It gets a little bit more each year. But we provide fly fishing programs, and we have strong partnership with Department of Veterans Affairs to make sure that we have participants, and our programs are open to disabled veterans and wounded, ill, and injured active duty military personnel. The programs are run by volunteers, And we partner with a fly fishing organization if there's one there. If there's not one, we create one. But our big partners there are Trout Unlimited and Fly Fishers International, which have clubs and chapters across the country. If there's not one available in the area, we can create one under Fly Fishers International. So I think
that's key right there, what you just said. If you don't have one, if they don't have one, you create one, which there's no limit to stop you. You know what I mean? You're gonna make it happen regardless, and that is huge. That's awesome, man.
Yeah, we just need the volunteers that are willing to work with us to get it set up. So and we have partnerships with all of the fly fishing industry. I mean, Temple Fork Outfitters, Orvis, I mean, they're just two of our many, many supporters that just, we couldn't do it without them at the price. I mean, last year, for an entire year, one of our programs, it cost $225 per participant. We have just over 9,700 participants nationwide and just over 4,200 volunteers. The staff at headquarters is relatively small compared to those numbers. We have 14 full-time employees and four contract employees. So we're able to do that through our partnerships, number one, but primarily we have such amazing volunteers nationwide that really just make it happen. We have the country divided into 19 regions. Some regions are a single state, like North Carolina, Pennsylvania have a high number of programs, so they're their own region. And some of the bigger areas of the country, you know, Wyoming out west, and that way they're combined into several states into one region, just because the geography is less populated. However, we can, like I said, we can create a program anywhere. We just need people willing to work with us to do it. So we offer a fly fishing program. So we just, it's not like a one and done sort of thing. We have a program that has structure. There's five core program activities that we teach, and most of our participants have never fly fished a day in their life. I would say 9 out of 10 never even thought about it. And it falls under recreational therapy. It's legitimate. There's science behind it. It definitely works for people that want it to work. And we have five core program activities. We have fly tying, so we teach someone how to tie a fly themselves. We have fly rod building, so we teach someone how to build their own fly rod. We have casting, so we teach them how to cast it. It's a unique sort of way to cast a fly rod to make it work properly. You have to kind of do it that way. We have fly fishing education, so we teach people how to, you know, how to understand how to use a fly rod, which fly do you use, but you know, what do you, how do you fish different types of water? There's you know, all kinds of stuff to learn there. You know, what type of bug does a fly represent in all its different phases? And then we have outings. So we have, you know, five core program activities. So the first four, you know, allow the last one to happen. So the idea is that a participant comes and we get to know them, teach them how to tie their own fly. They build their own fly rod. They cast it. They catch a fish with it on their own, on a fly they tied themselves, on a rod that they built themselves. And there's a sense of accomplishment in that. It's really hard. I think whoever invented fly fishing decided to figure out what's the most difficult way to catch a fish, and that's what fly fishing is all about. So it's not even easy to do to start with, and we're going to have you tie your own fly and build your own rod and go out and kind of, you know, catch some fish. So and we release them, so there's, you know, there's no, you don't get anything for yourself. What you do get though is you get a good feeling, I think, because the people that are around in the program and making this happen are fellow veterans that have, you know, their own issues that they're trying to deal with. And you have a bunch of volunteers who genuinely really do care about you, and they want you to be okay in your own way. And that sort of, you know, that love that circulates in the program can heal. And the activities that we have are mindful, and that mindfulness has a power to bring us right into the present, which is the only place that you can heal. So you can't heal in the past, you can't heal in the future. And if we're constantly dragging the past into the present it's going to form our future for us. And so we believe that you can come join our program and we can help you get some new good memories to fade those others out. And as you spend more time in the program, you start to feel better. And, you know, we're always going to have these things to deal with, but it's easier to deal with issues if you have a good bunch of people around you that care about you. And that genuine concern plays a big role in how healing happens. So that's how our program works. People can join. It's not a member organization. We do register people through our Salesforce CRM so that we know who's in what program so we can track things. But we don't talk about whatever you want. But generally what we're talking about is tying flies and building fly rods, and you're around a bunch of people that want to do that too, and it works. And the mindfulness of fly tying and rod building and casting, all that stuff, is going to plant you both your feet right in the present, and then healing can start to occur. And however long it takes is however long it takes. Our programs, about 50% of our program participants are Vietnam veterans, and the rest are from Cold War and post 9/11. It's a good mixture of generations. There's a lot of good friendship and camaraderie that happens at the program level that we all miss from our days in the military. So that comes back to you. And now you have volunteers also that maybe they didn't serve, but they really love to serve this cause. And they do a great job of doing it in a way that makes a huge difference. And I think last year we had 742 participants become volunteers. So we have a high number of participants like me. I would start off as a participant who become volunteers. And that's sort of an affirmation that healing's happening and you're ready to give back. And, when your cup's half full instead of half empty, life starts to fall into place for you. And I believe that whether your cup is half full is whether you're drinking or pouring, right? So if you're pouring, it's half full. If you're drinking, it's half empty. So we want to get people feeling like they can pour for others and give back. So and there's a ton of healing that happens when you have that sort of feeling. And there's six emotions, as sadness, surprise, anger, fear, and disgust, that are, generally looked at as negative emotions. And when that sixth emotion goes away, which is joy, those ones take over, our life can be pretty miserable. And we want to bring joy back and make joy bigger and give people, some joyful memories and feelings that they can put in their memories that are going to help them kind of move in a direction that's going to be healthy for them.
Gotcha. Now, can you donate? Can anybody that's listening donate to the organization?
Yep. So that's our only source of revenue is donations. So you can go to our website at www.projecthealingwaters.org. There's a donate button there and you can donate whatever you feel will help us. Like I said earlier, last year it cost us $225 per participant for a full year in our programs for our core program activities. We do overnight outings as well, and local programs raise that money themselves for that. And those aren't counted in that expense. But the expense, most of the programs do local outings and fish locally. The programs are locally focused, local volunteers, the vets come from the community. And if they raise money locally, it stays with the program. So we don't take revenue from the programs. That revenue is used for direct program expenses, and we fund the indirect program expenses from headquarters.
No, I think it's a great organization, man. And like you said, that's a key thing. A lot of vets, when they get out, they lose that sense of purpose, that the camaraderie, I'm not relevant anymore. You know what I mean? And I think it takes a toll. And then other stuff that, dealing with, your wartime, your PTSD, all that kind of just starts a snowball. And some veterans, it takes on worse and they get suicidal, and that's it's a terrible thing. It's, I don't know how true the 22 is a day, but if it is times 365 days times 20 years, That's a lot of veterans, you know. It's terrible. And we'll get into that. I want to ask you a question about that here in just a little bit. I think anybody listening, you should go to the website. You know, if you can donate, please do. It's for a great cause. Obviously, you just heard what Todd was saying. I think any amount would help, you know.
Yes. No amount is too small, for sure. And I will say about suicides, in my mind, one is too many. So we need to take that rate down to zero. And the five words that I hear the most about our programs is, this program saved my life. So who knew that fly fishing could do that? And I think our founder, Ed Nicholson, who was a Vietnam veteran himself and a retired Navy captain, knew exactly what fly fishing can do for people when they're struggling and losing hope. And the impact of these programs on people is profound. And like I said, you know, when someone tells you the program saved their life, and we have volunteers, I've had volunteers tell me that as well.
Wow.
That's a pretty powerful statement.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What advice would you give your younger self? I think it's a creative question, and it could apply to anybody. You know, if you're listening, think of what you would tell your younger self, good or bad.
Yeah, I would probably tell my younger self that life is hard, but it's harder if you can't learn from your mistakes. There's been some times in my life where I just didn't learn from my mistakes. And, you know, we can't go through life screwing everything up as a way of learning. So, you know, I can be pretty hard-headed sometimes, and I don't think that always works out the best for me. Although when it's necessary, it's actually what makes all the difference. So, but I've learned that that's not a good way to be, and there's been some tough lessons with that as well. So, but I would also say that for my younger self, that no matter how hard it gets, life's always worth living, and it's never worth stepping out of it for any reason. And if you surround yourself with people that care about you, you're always going to be okay, as long as you listen to them. And a lot of times we don't listen to the people who care about us the most, and that's often some of our biggest mistakes. So I had the good pleasure to work with and know the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Joe Dunford, my entire life. He's a personal friend and mentor to me. And when I was a younger person, he told me that someone had told him three things that are going to make you successful in life. And the first one is surround yourself with good people. And he couldn't remember the other two. So that's really the secret to success in life, is to surround yourself with good people. And I would say always move. And those people need to be the type that'll move to the sound of gunfire with you.
I agree. If I want to get into the 22 a day part now, if there's a veteran out there that is on the brinks of suicide or have suicidal thoughts, what's something that if you were on the phone with one had called you right now, what would you tell that veteran?
Well, I would talk them out of it for sure. Whatever's going on, whatever they're struggling with, there's a way out of it, for sure. I mean, it's hard. You know, we come, those of us that serve in the military, you know, we come from a culture and environment where you're told to suck it up and move on. And unfortunately, I had a problem of thinking that way at times as well, because that's what we needed to do to survive, right? So, and it's really difficult for us to ask for help because we're there to serve other people, particularly if you're coming from a leadership position as well. It's just not in your DNA to ask for help. You're there to help other people. And so when we get out of that environment and we're on our own and we need help, we got to ask for it. I mean, it's okay not to be okay. You got to ask for help. You got to ask. Okay. Because there's people out there that do care. There's a lot of people that do care, and you might not even know who they are. But if you reach out, you're going to get help. So I know the VA has suicide hotline, and there's a lot of those things going on. But, you know, if people that have reached out to me in that situation, you know, I've convinced them that there's different ways to solve a problem. You know, I mean, that's might be a way. I think it's unacceptable. A better way might be to kind of just work through what's going on.
Absolutely. I got a couple more, and then I'll let you get going for the day. I know you've seen it. I got out in 07. It was starting to change when I was getting out. The way the military is changing with discipline, how you can't holler at soldiers anymore. You know, there's so many changes going on. You think that's a good thing or a bad thing? I feel it loses discipline, you know what I mean, when you can't really get on Joe because they're kind of ruling the military now, you know?
Yeah, I mean things change. I don't believe in this sort of false dichotomy where things are black and white, you know. I'm not saying I never yelled at anybody before, but it wasn't my style to do that as a leader. I'd rather sit down and talk to them and figure out what's going on. So I think if the military's trying to promote that more, then we're setting people up for success after they get out of the military a little bit better with that, mm-hmm. for sure, because most people don't stay in the military for a career. So, I don't know. I never really appreciated getting yelled at by people. I just kind of lose respect for them pretty quickly. So, unless there's a reason. I mean, there were times I deserved to get yelled at, and I knew it. So I was getting my butt chewed. I was getting my butt chewed because I needed to, and I wasn't listening. And the leader who was chewing my butt had tried everything except, you know, pinning me down. And like I said, there were times in my life when I was younger that I could be pretty hard-headed and wasn't listening. And this leader had my best interests in mind. I just didn't realize it. And that person cared about it enough about me to go to an extreme to make me listen. And so it worked. So, you know, there's pros and cons to everything. I think the judgment of a leader to apply different approaches to folks is what's most important. But, you know, I'm not one to default to that right away, I guess. And so if we can develop thoughtful, caring leaders, you know, that try everything, and if they do get frustrated or they have a bad day, they understand it, you know, it's just not a good way to lead people. I mean, there are situations when you have to yell. I mean, in combat we were yelling because we couldn't hear each other. I wasn't yelling at them, but you want people to follow you willingly, and that's a big challenge for leadership, is having willing compliance. And a lot of that is the example that we set ourselves. So if we set a good example, and people are willing to follow us, they should be able to ask questions, and we should provide a reasonable explanation of what we're doing and why we're doing it. If we can't, then we need to reassess what we're doing.
Yeah. The main reason why I asked that, you know, you were in infantry, I was in infantry, and it's all male dominance, alpha male type. And, you know, you got guys coming from everywhere, and some are stronger, some are weaker, some are just, you can't get through to them. They're just messing up, you know, and I think sometimes you got to use that, you know what I mean, to get a point across to all of them, like, hey, this is the standard, this is the way it's going to be, and if not, step out, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and we have requirements in the military that are different from what you see in the private sector. I mean, people's lives depend on willing compliance to orders in the military, for sure. And I've been in a lot of situations where that was in fact the case. And, you know, once you're in the middle of it, you got to do it. So, people need to understand that. You can get to that point without yelling at people, though.
Yeah. I got three speed round questions I want to ask you, and then I'll let you go for the day. One is, do you carry a handgun? And if you do, what model is it and why?
I don't carry a handgun. if I did, I'd have a Les Bear 45 because that is just an absolute amazing weapon.
Yeah. Yeah. Favorite vacation spot and where and why?
I like Bar Harbor, Maine. That's where I'm from. I get good memories from there. My wife and I went on our honeymoon there. We've been married for 28 years. It's just a wonderful place for me. I love it.
Favorite sport and why? Last question.
So I played rugby for 25 years, I guess.
Really?
So rugby is my favorite sport. I started playing in college, and I got into it in the Marine Corps. Had a rugby team. Every unit I was in as an officer, I felt like officers should provide contact sports for the battalion. And rugby was a sport that I loved. I can teach it. And I became a certified coach under USA Rugby for level three all the way up to the select side of it, and coached for 15 of the 25 years I was a coach. I was a head coach for the All Marine rugby team several times, and a player as well. I played scrum half, so I was always the smallest guy on the field. So I learned how to take a beating and keep going in that sport for sure. I love it. It's such a great sport. It's so much fun to play. I can't play now, obviously, because of my injuries, but I'd still be playing right now if I didn't get banged up and have a brain injury. The camaraderie and friendship. So, I mean, a lot of my best friends are guys I played rugby with for many, many years. And so I just think it's a fantastic sport. I'm so glad to see the sevens version of it in the Olympics and see the United States kind of progressing, because before they brought it back, the United States was the gold medalist from 1920 for rugby. So we have great athletes in this country. That's a great sport for people who are super into fitness and athletics, and moral and physical courage on the rugby pitch is a requirement.
Last question, man, and I'll let you go for the day. What is your greatest sense of accomplishment, whether it be in the military or out of the military? Or both?
I'm super proud of my kids. They were raised, in a military environment during time of war. I mean, my wife is amazing. She was having to be mom and dad. I was, we figured out when I retired, I was deployed for 8 years of our marriage, overseas, gone, and that doesn't count all the time we spent in the field. So they've had a lot of adversity, moving around a lot, different schools here and there, and they rose to the challenge, and they're all super successful right now, participating as productive citizens in this country. And I'm just super proud of them and, my wife and all the effort it took to help them grow up to be the wonderful people that they are. So I'm very proud of them.
Oh, that's an awesome answer. Todd, it was an honor to have you on. You got a great story. You're doing great things with the organization, and I'll post a link of how to where they can click it and go to the organization to donate. If you want to help with it, there's all different kinds of things you can do. So, man, it was an honor to have you on. I was glad to share your story. Stay in touch with me.
Yes, sir.
Thank you again for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And thanks to everybody out there who's listening for all you're doing. It's a great nation, and there's a lot of great things ahead for us.
Absolutely. Yes, sir. Take care.